Hi there, listener, and welcome to this special episode of the Ski Podcast. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Paddy Graham, who I first met when he was one of the first, possibly second wave of British skiers breaking out of the dry slopes and the snow domes into the international limelight back in the early 2000s. He is an extremely accomplished freeride and freestyle skier, but he maybe is best known for his incredibly creative ski films that he's starred in and produced, and he's also co-founder of the legendary production company Legs of Steel. Hi Paddy, welcome to the Ski Podcast. How are you today?
I'm great, thank you for that lovely intro.
Excellent. Tell me, where are you today?
At the moment, I'm at home in Chur in Switzerland. I moved here last summer after spending 10 years in Innsbruck.
Right. What prompted the move from Austria to Switzerland then?
My wife is Swiss, and we'd been living in Innsbruck for about 5 years. And when she came to Innsbruck, she said she'll come for 1 year. And then five years down the line, we were married and had a child. And it was about time to move back to Switzerland, a bit closer to her family. So, yeah, we took the plunge last summer.
that kind of makes sense. I did notice on your Instagram feed, you have a son who's just starting to ski. Is that right?
Yeah, he's 2 and 3 months tomorrow. He got on skis. He got skis for Christmas, courtesy of my lovely ski partners, sponsors. But it's amazing fun to take him and give him a go.
Oh, well, you know, he's very lucky to be living out in resort and getting to ski so young. I can't tell you how I know this, because I did a bunch of research prior to us chatting today, but I think his birthday is on the 27th of December. Is that right?
It is, yeah.
It's also the birthday of my kids. I have twins.
Oh, wow.
So I'm thinking, you know, what it was like for us was just coming up to Christmas, hoping, oh my God, I hope they're not born on Christmas Day.
Yeah, it was the longest Christmas week ever.
You mentioned that you moved from Innsbruck to Switzerland recently, and I know you've been living in Innsbruck, and one of the, I guess, the motivations for living there was you are part of the Legs of Steel company. I wondered if you could just explain what Legs of Steel is.
Yeah, so it started back in, I think, 2009. I'd been on the vocal team for a couple of years, and I'd met a lot of the athletes that live out in Europe there. And I think coming from the UK, I always wanted to sort of break onto the European scene or break onto the international scene. And through Focal, I managed to ski with a lot of people in Europe and go to events in Europe. And during those first few years being over here, yeah, I met some great people, became really good friends with, and we kind of had a little ski gang. And someone dubbed us Legs of Steel because we would go big on jumps. Toby, Thomas, and Benny, they were like, oh, why don't you move to Innsbruck? A couple of them were studying there, and it's a really good sort of hub for free skiing and the scene, so to say. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I can do that. You know, I do ski seasons and then I go home and I'll work and then I go out in the summer. And they were like, yeah, you know, it's the European Union. You can live wherever you want. Just come and move here. And I was like, oh, okay, that sounds good. So, yeah, I moved to Innsbruck with them. We got a house. And then I didn't have to keep driving back to England all the time.
How did that segue from being a group of people called Legs of Steel because of the type of skiing you were doing to actually becoming a production company, let's say?
Yeah, we were filming with another European production company at the time, and they made movies called Astivation. Basically, you would go on trips and film for these movies, and then you wouldn't see any of the footage all summer, and then you would go to a premiere in autumn, and you'd sit in the cinema and you'd watch all the footage that you got through the year and see the film, but you wouldn't have any control over the tricks or the editing or the music or anything like that. And I think we got a little bit frustrated, or, you know, we said, oh, we could do this better. even though none of us could film or edit or anything. But we knew we had a vision and we knew what we wanted to make. So we said, oh, let's make our own ski film and we can use the music we like. We can go on the trips we like. We can, you know, make the editing, the stories how we want. We did that with our first movie. The pilot came out in 2010. A big thing for us was actually the music. We wanted to have music we liked. A lot of free skiing was, they were into like reggae music back then. And we were like, oh, we want rock music. No one has rock music. So we kind of defined our style through rock music.
Right. Well, we'll come on to the different, you know, movies and films that you've produced. I wondered if I could just take you back a little bit before that, because, you know, you're saying you're a, you know, you're a professional athlete, you're sponsored by Vocal, you're in films. But you started skiing through a school trip, is that right?
Yeah, Sheffield has got it used to have the dry ski slope. I'd always seen the dry ski slope, and there were a pair of skis in the garage from my dad, because he skied a little bit when he was younger. We'd not been on a holiday or we'd not been up to the ski slope before. And that summer I decided to do, yeah, like a taster course to get into, to learn to ski. Because during the summers or the school holidays, my parents would always send us on like sports camps, or if it was trampolining or climbing or like general sports. I even remember going on snorkeling classes at like a local swimming pool. So this was just like another one of those sports to try and get into. And once I started skiing, I guess I got the bug right away. And I knew at the high school that there would be a ski trip opportunity. So it was all kind of leading up to having the opportunity to go on to that ski trip with the school.
Yeah, cool. Where did you go?
We went to Stowe. And I think on the last day, we stayed a night in New York before we flew out, it was absolutely amazing.
Very cool. I actually used to work for Crystal Schools. It's a Crystal Ski Schools product. And, you know, you'd be surprised how many teachers are quite keen to take a group over to the States. And Stowe was always a popular one. You mentioned Sheffield. So you lived in Sheffield and Sheffield Ski Village. You already referred to the fact that, you know, unfortunately, it's not there anymore as a feature. But the time that you went when you did your Learn to Ski course was definitely the halcyon days of Sheffield Ski Village, because I went up there quite a few times when I was doing natives to go to different events. And I think Sheffield Ski Village was always different from the other dry slopes around because it had lots of freestyle features built into it, didn't it?
Just as I learned to ski, they just finished off like the new fun park slope. They'd got a half pipe, a cliff drop, a jump, a quarter pipe, rails. They'd even got a water ramp. And I remember learning to ski and like looking over and seeing people on this like immaculate white matting because it was brand new. And I was just like, wow, that looks really cool. And it was the skiing that attracted me. I don't know. I never was pulled towards snowboarding. So it was always the skiing from day one.
Yeah. And Sheffield itself was like a hub for freestylers at the time. I'm not sure how many listeners would know Andy Bennett. I think he now you know, works as an instructor, but Andy Bennett, and then a couple of years later, maybe definitely people would know James Woodsy Woods.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what was great with, I mean, what's Sheffield is, you know, it's like the outdoor city. It's close to the Peak District. For the ski slope, it was just such a nice vibe every time you went there. There was a ski club. Then there were lots of snowboarders, skiers, they would have events. And what was great, whenever we would go skiing, we ended up sort of, yeah, always going on Thursdays and Saturdays. And it wasn't just skiers up there, there were snowboarders up there and everyone would ski together. There was no two scenes, it was just one big one. And it was just amazing, amazing fun. I always remember skiing into the night with the music on and the floodlights. And it was a really nice atmosphere to be in.
Yeah, I mean, when I was doing natives in the early 2000s, then we you know, we did a number of things. And we first met when natives got involved in a quarter pipe at the Birmingham Ski Show. And Pat Sharples at the time, who I've interviewed on the podcast, listeners, you can listen to that now, a coach for GB Park and Pipe, GB Snow Sports. He had brought together this group of Groms, as he called them, as a demo. And you look at it now, there is some of that footage, you know, around on YouTube, and it seems so kind of basic. But I massive respect to the organizers of the show for actually, you know, investing in creating this quarter pipe out of scaffolding and a bit of matting. But lots of the skiers he and snowboarders who took part there became big names in the industry. And I think you were one of those in one of those years as well.
Yeah, I remember that the show at the it was at the NEC in Birmingham, and I think the Line had a ski team at the time. It was Line and Nike CG sponsored it as well. And we would do demos during the day. I think we had to do 4 or 5 demos during the day. So they'd put on these shows. And then on the weekend, there was the big competition that came on where, yeah, more kids from around the scene got invited together to put on a show. The ramp that they used to build at all those events, like, they were really scary to be stood up at the top of drop in such a small space, small transition. And then once you were done, yeah, you'd have to get off, then you'd have to walk back up to the top.
They weren't, you know, particularly high tech as such. And I think those were all constructed by Stu Brass and Spencer Claridge, who, you know, went on to organize the Brits. They were doing the AIM series were competitions around that time, which I can't even remember what that stands for now, but they were a bunch of freestyle competitions for skiers and snowboarders.
Artificial indoor mountain, I think.
There you go. Very good. That's
yeah, because I think they had the outdoor series, they had the indoor one, and then they had the Brits on the mountains, yeah.
But, you know, at that time, it was all very new. And one of the things looking back on those videos is just looking at all the kids at the bottom of the slope there, just in awe at what was going on. And I think that, you know, freestyle skiing, certainly in the UK, you know, there hadn't been any of it before, prior to that. Although, you know, I think in the introduction, I said that maybe you were in the second generation of, you know, UK free skiers. I mentioned I interviewed Pat, and I've also interviewed Jim Adlington before. Were they like mentors to you at all?
I remember being at a few events and they were the accomplished pros back then. You know, they were out doing the ski seasons, and then at the end of the ski season, they'd come back and then you'd see them at some events. Yeah, Pat, Jim. There was James Vernon, Dave Young, Glenn Parsons. I remember he was a very mysterious character. He was the best. He could do Cork Sevens. I think he was sponsored by K2. Yeah, there was a lot of them, but Pat really put together the scene in the UK and got together the next generation from them, I'd say.
Yeah, well, it was amazing the way he pulled together, you know, all of the younger athletes through those Grom camps who then, you know, we've seen them progress and you progress. But you mentioned they were doing seasons already. And I think that you went on to do seasons and you kind of had to get sort of permission from your parents to kind of leave education to be able to do that.
Once I'd done my GCSEs, it was, you know, that was the end of mandatory education. So the first thing that all my friends said to me, they're like, oh, you need to go and do a ski season. I was like, oh, my parents aren't going to be happy with that. What actually happened after I'd done my GCSEs, I was friends with Ben Hawker, Bungle, and he was going out to do a season in Sir Chevalier with Noddy Gowans. And Noddy, the mastermind that he is, he'd been pitching a TV show to the Discovery Channel, Snow Patrol. They pitched for this show and it hadn't been commissioned yet, but it was all in the pipeline. I was invited to be part of that show, and I could use that as a bit of leverage on my parents to be able to go out and do a ski season with something to come back and show, I guess. My parents said, yeah, you need to go to school and you need to talk to the head of PE and the head of sixth form. And I remember going in and thinking, oh, you know, they're not going to let me do it, or I have to, you know, do homeschooling or something whilst I'm away. I sat down and they said, oh, you know, your parents have called and they've told us everything that's going on. Sounds brilliant. You know, take the opportunity, go and do it. School's here next year. If you want to come back, go for it now, because you might not get the chance again.
And that is really good to hear that you had such a supportive side of things. I do believe, again, somewhere in my research, I came across this quote though, where maybe you said you asked the PE department, but did your rugby coach not say to you, oh, well, there's no point skiing, there's no future in that?
Oh, that was quite a few years before that, I think. Yeah, I used to play rugby on a Saturday morning. When I got into skiing more and more, I'd want to go to the ski slope on a Saturday. He was the math teacher and the rugby coach. And I said, oh, I can't play rugby anymore. We're going to go skiing. And he said, oh, I think he like pulled me aside after a class one day or something and said, oh, you're not going to get anywhere with that. So I think that probably lit the fire early to just to prove Mr. Brennan in the maths department, to prove him wrong.
Excellent. And so, you did do that season. And then, your career, I guess, really went forward full speed. I wanted to ask you about a trip you did out to the States, I'm not sure the year, but mid-2000s anyway, which was out to Colorado and what was called like a Grom's Tour. You were filming on that as well, another TV
Yeah,
series maybe?
so that was also the first year I did the ski season. So the first part of the year, the first part of the winter, I was filming for the Discovery Channel, and then we went on this 3 week trip to the US. It was with Channel 5, TV show called Rad, and this was called Grom's Ride the Rockies. Christine Stevenson was the presenter; he was orchestrating the whole thing. So he got five young athletes together. Skiers, two skiers, three snowboarders, and within this his crew, he'd got the production crew, and then he got a lot of older snowboarders to come out and kind of mentor us and hang out with us and have a good time. And it was an absolute blast. I'm still friends with everyone that we did that trip with. And funnily enough, Wayne Yates, he was the director of Rad, and he now works at Rebel Media House. So I still work with him almost 20 years later.
Who were the other four athletes then?
Murray Buchan, he was skiing, and then we had Ben Kilner on the snowboard, James Carr, and Laura Berry.
So, I mean, that sounds like an amazing track. I was listening to another podcast completely unrelated to all of this recently, and I think it was an interview with Adam Gendel, who was maybe filming, and he was talking about a really bad wipeout he had. Was that on that trip?
There was yeah, so Gendel was out there with us, Tim Warwood, Ed Lee, James McPhail, a photographer, Matt Barr, journalist. They were all out there with us, and Jono Verity came out with us, and it was Jono who had the big slam.
There you go. I knew it was one of those guys.
Yeah,
Yeah.
we were in Park City, and the weather wasn't great, so we were kind of cruising around the small parks having fun, and Jono, he was still filming. He wanted to film for his section of the TSA movie, so he was out over at the big jumps. Terrible weather, probably windy, and no one else was there. But he was out there hitting the big one, and I think he did a huge front three or front five. Big crash, went huge on the jump. And I remember us seeing a helicopter coming and leaving, and we were like, "Oh, whoa, crazy! Look at that!" And someone came over and went, "Oh, Jono's in that helicopter," and he'd had a big crash and collapsed his lung. So none of the kids were hurt on the trip, but one of the pros with us, he ended up in the hospital.
Yeah, well, the good news is it all worked out in the end. And it's interesting, some of the other people you mentioned on that trip, because listeners, if you want to kind of explore all of these connections, if you look through the back catalogue, you'll be able to listen to my interview with Tim Warwood and also with Ed Lee, and all of these pieces, fit together. And you mentioned Ben Kilner and Murray Buchan. They both went on to become Olympians, and you had, a very successful competitive career early on. London Freeze, I mean, that was an amazing event. We could probably talk about that quite a bit, but you didn't, continue on to the Olympics like some of, your friends at the time. But I believe that Red Bull, who you were, an athlete for now, did kind of want you to go down that route at one point.
I mean, by the time the Olympics came up into the scene and it was accepted for slopestyle, I was already spending my whole seasons filming backcountry skiing. So I'd already moved away from competing in slopestyle and focusing more on backcountry skiing. And then the Olympics came around, slopestyle got in. And yeah, I remember having a conversation with Pat and my then manager at Red Bull, and they said, "Oh, kind of the same as having that conversation with the teachers back when I was 16, and they said, oh, you know, it's the opportunity, and if you don't give it a go, maybe you'll regret that in a few years. So then I went on to training with the British team. I think I trained with them in Sasfe in the summer, and then I went to New Zealand to train with them. But off the back end of that trip in New Zealand, I was going straight to Chile to compete in the Swatch Skiers Cup, which is a big mountain event. So while I was trying to train for slopestyle and whatever with a national team, I was also competing in big mountain events. We were trying to make ski movies. And I think by the time the end of the second season came around, where we were doing the competitions and qualifying for the Olympics, I was committed to the team and to slopestyle, but I was still trying to juggle filming and backcountry. So I wasn't in it 100%. And by the time the last two or three contests came around, you know, I still had an all right chance at getting the points for doing it. But I just realized maybe I wasn't as committed as some people were. And then I ended up packing it in. And then it was back to filming full time.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's definitely each to their own. And it's very clear from our conversations and, you know, your history that the filming side of things and that free ride side of things, you know, is your passion, essentially. You know, listeners may recall a segment from Ski Sunday, you know, a few years ago, and you've been on Ski Sunday a few times, but the one they might remember was, you know, moving on from that a couple of years, one of the movies that you produced through Legs of Steel was called Same Difference, I think. And that features what most people would think of as the jump, the kicker of all time. I think it was billed as an attempt to redefine gravity.
I'll quickly touch on what the movie was. The movie was, it was called Same Difference, and it was, we wanted to showcase three different disciplines within skiing. So we had alpine racing with Felix Neureuther, backcountry or free ride skiing, with a crew in Alaska, and then the freestyle part of it came from us trying to break the world record of airtime on a jump. And the idea came from a drone operator that we work a lot with, Christoph Torrensen. He was a pro snowboarder earlier in his career. And he said they once built this big jump in the backcountry, and they were going way over 3 seconds of airtime, almost 4 seconds of airtime. And no one ever talks about how long you spend in the air anymore. It's all about how long you jump or how high you jump. And it's not, the calculation doesn't come to having the longest airtime, the longest flight curve. So we were like, well, that sounds really interesting. We like big jumps. We like lots of airtime. Let's look into that. And yeah, we proposed it to Red Bull as a project, which they supported 100%. And then once we actually got into it and started the designs and started doing calculations and looking at the science, really, we realized we needed a massive jump. And we had a really great partner in Mottolino Mountain in Livigno, who were pretty much crazy enough to build this jump with us. They started pushing snow, I think in December, with us. We would hit the jump in the end of April, May time. So they were pushing snow the whole season long to make this big plateau, and just a really huge landing for us to give it a go. And by the time it was finished, it was huge.
So I have a lot of questions about this. You mentioned like the science, the maths side of things. What were your calculations then? What did you actually need to be able to create and do?
Well, it all came down to, I mean, obviously speed and distance, but it was about the takeoff angle of the jump and then the angle of the landing. In theory, what we did, we were quite a steep takeoff, almost like a hip. Where you would usually you go for the highest air on a hip and you land on the side. But then, yeah, the landing was the special part, which it was really steep. So a little bit more speed that you would take, a little bit more distance, would mean that you fell further down and could get a more air time coming down the landing. And it was one of the steepest landings at the time, I guess, that they'd ever built and used a snowcat to groom. so much that it was, they didn't know if it was possible to do it with a machine. They did find a guy crazy enough to drive the cat up there, French cat driver, and he came and he built the landing for us.
And may I ask, I mean, Red Bull pay for it. You know, how much did it cost to create this? I mean, they're working on it for 4 months or something.
A few hundred thousand euros, I'm sure. It was just a lot of time, man hours. There was a huge excavator building the landing for weeks and weeks. They had to, because the landing was so steep, they had to make kind of like a tiered landing using big pieces of wood. It was absolutely nuts.
I think I'm right in saying that it was so large and there was so much snow there that there was like an avalanche warning for the town below or something like that.
Yeah, the town below, they saw this big pile of snow and they called the local police to ask if it was safe. Huge amount of snow stuck out of the slope above the village.
So you came out there in April and the goal is to get, you know, 4 seconds of airtime. Did you practice it or did you go straight into it?
Yeah, there was no practice. The original plan was that you could jump to the sides of it and build your way up to be able to clear the whole jump like a hit. But ultimately, when they built the jump, it was so big that they couldn't finish the hip landing to the end. So we could hit it a couple of times and jump halfway into the side of the jump, basically. But then it was like, okay, if we want to go over it, you kind of need to take what you've learned now and go for it. We did have like the calculation of the speed that we needed, which was between 110 and 117 kilometers per hour. The problem with that is that we had a speed track when you were coming into the jump, but when you go in 115 kilometers per hour, you don't have time to look at the display on the side, see if you're going fast enough, and then look back at the jump and think, okay, I can stop. I need to stop, or I can go. It was a case of finding a spot up on the mountain to drop in at like 500 or 600 meters above, and you'd point it in, and then you would go as fast as you can, and then you could pull out just before the jump, and then you'd say, okay, how fast did I go? How fast did I go? And I was with a group of my friends hitting it. I think there were five or six skiers. And as the day went on, the day when we were going to hit it, I realized people started to disappear. they were on the sidelines watching, and at the end, just before we hit the jump, there were only three of us left, myself, Tom Rich, and Lucas Joas. And I was like, okay, these guys, they've been doing quite a lot of speed tests. I think one of them might hit it. And I went up there. I was like, okay, what's happening then? They're like, yeah, it's time to go. I was like, okay, who's going? And they're like, you're going. And I was like, okay.
Talk us through what happened.
Yeah, I mean, the scene is in the movie. You can watch that on Red Bull TV. But yeah, we were stood up there and we had a big windsock on a 10 meter pole next to the jump, so we were watching the wind all the time, because obviously you don't want a gust with something like that. And yeah, we just stood up there and I think we were all just in a bit of a trance, and then all of a sudden it was time to go, and I went for it, and yeah, went off the jump, and it was like literally like being shot out of a cannon. I think the takeoff degree was about 48 degrees. A normal jump is maybe 37, so it was really steep. And I just remember being poof, pinged off, and I was up in the air. I was like, oh my God, I'm up here, and kept going. I was like, okay, I see the landing, see the knuckle, boom. Got my landing, and then there was the hell ride down this landing, the steepest landing ever. It was huge. Got to the bottom, and he had a huge sense of relief that the jump worked. Everyone had been building it for so long, made it over, and yeah, it was amazing. So that was the first hit.
So perfection. That was great. But for some reason, you decided to give it another go.
Yeah, so myself, Tom, and Lucas hit it. Lucas, he went a little bit big and crashed. He was totally fine. The landing is steep, so you know, you can kind of control your crash, and it was fine. Tom had a really good hit on it, really composed, straight into the landing. And we said from the beginning of the project, you know, everything has to be perfect. It's not a jump that you want to take risks on. So we went back up, you know, lots of high fives, and we were like, okay, should we go again? We all really liked the jump. We were like, oh, this is going to work. It's really good. But in that time, the wind had started to pick up. So we looked at the wind and we looked at the windsock and we said, okay, let's call it for today. We know the jump's good. And they wanted to cut the jump out and make it look all nice and put the branding on it and everything. We'll wait for the next good day. And then I think there was another 2 or 3 days of bad weather in between that of us going to hit it again. And then the next day we went up to hit it. There'd been some snow, there'd been some rain, and it was cloudy. So people were like, oh, we don't know if it's the best time to do it now. And I was like, you know, we've already done it once, you know, let's crack on and get the session going, even if it's not totally perfect with the light. And then, yeah, the first jump I did that day, I was going, I think, maybe 5 kilometers faster than the day before. The lip of the jump had also not been totally salted, so it wasn't totally hard. And I dropped in. I was pretty confident, but just in the bottom of the transition, I was like, "Oh, this is quite fast." So I kind of knew that I was going a bit fast, not knowing that the lip of the jump wasn't totally perfect to get the optimal degree. And yeah, I went off, and I was going up, and I was going up, and I was going up, and I was like, "Uh-oh, this is a big one." Went over the knuckle. I must have been a good 10 meters above the knuckle, and I was going, and I just saw the landing disappearing below me. And I was like, okay, all you need to do is stay composed, land on your feet, and then you can, you know, wash out onto your side and slide down. And I landed on my feet, slid onto my side, I guess. But since the landing was, I landed about way halfway down the landing, maybe a little bit more. And then with that landing and then going sideways and then the snow being soft and catching, it caught my skis and bucked my skis, and I felt my knee pop, felt my ankle, something hurt there. And when I came to a standstill, I just remember being like, okay, I'm here. I sort of sat up, could move my arms, nothing hurt too much. I knew my knee hurt. I remember touching my shoulders, being like, you know, is everything attached almost. But I stood up and I was like, okay, my knee hurts, ankle hurts. And then, yeah, I'd done my ACL, meniscus, and I'd broken a bone in my other ankle on the other leg. And there was the ski next to me. It was snapped in half. I've never snapped a ski. I've never seen a snapped ski. And that was it for the day.
I'm sure that was it for the day. I mean, just the concept. I think, you know, anyone who's listening to this right now, like I'm listening to it, I feel like I'm on the edge of my seat listening to the whole of that story. But this is kind of indicative of the type of things that you've done in your career. You've always been sort of pushing boundaries a little bit further, whether it's for yourself or also just on the creativity side of things, you know, coming up with that idea. And, you know, there's other movies that listeners can watch. There's one called Action Men from 2020, which has a brilliant stop motion section in it, which I've never seen in a ski movie before. That is brilliant. But another one that, you know, listeners might be familiar with, again, possibly because they would have, you know, seen it on Ski Sunday on the broader audience. But there's something called The Ultimate Run, which was starring Marcus Ader. And that was a Legs of Steel production, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And if listeners haven't seen it, you know, I'll put a link. You just got to watch it. But to me, the skiing is amazing. But what I love about that is just the creativity that has gone into it. The ideas that have gone into that, redefining really what you can do as a skier. There's one bit where he uses avalanche barriers as rails. I don't know if that's ever been done before, but I just think that's amazing. And another bit where he's on a lorry and I think he does a backflip off a lorry as it pulls to a stop or something like that. You know, I wondered, how does that creative process work when you're trying to come up with something like that?
For that project, we always say if an athlete comes to us with an idea, then we go 100% into that and back that, and we want that to work. Because working with athletes, that's where you I feel like you get the most reward. And also athletes have really, really good ideas. A lot of the time they're very crazy, but they're always, you know, if someone comes to you with an idea and they want to do it, then you know that they're committed to it. And when Marcus came in and presented his idea, which I think maybe only a quarter of his idea is actually in the Ultimate Run. So you can imagine the kind of things that were going on in his head. But yeah, it was, you know, he came in and we talked about it and we were like, right, we need to make this a reality, get the partners on board, get the right film team, the right director for him to work with. Yeah, make it a reality, basically. And it was an absolutely amazing project to see come to fruition.
Oh, it's amazing to watch. What about the locations? Did you have that in mind already? Because there's a castle kind of towards the end with some brilliant setups in there.
Yes, it's all mainly based in Marcus's home ski resort of Klausberg, and in his valley, the Arntal. So a lot of the skiing went down in Klausberg. The castle is down in the bottom of the valley there. The big mountain stuff with the glaciers, that's all in Zermatt. The project is that it was 2020 it started, and midway through production, we were hit with the pandemic. Luckily for the project meant that there was a closed ski resort for us to take advantage of. The ski resort were very cooperative. They let Marcus keep skiing there. We were allowed to keep filming. It's really funny, actually, like the parts in the ski resort that you see when you see people skiing, they're all extras that we had to come in. You know, Marcus had to get his friends to come ski, his family. We had to use production assistants to ski down the slope to make it look like that it was actually open. So on one side, we were hit with the constraints of lockdown and things like that. But on the other side, the ski resorts in Italy that winter were closed, which kind of meant he could have complete freedom to do whatever he wanted.
So you've got your shot list. You know what you want to put together, and you thought about how you're going to do it, and you found your locations. But you still need to get the right conditions to be able to make that happen. So are you having to kind of respond that really, you know, short notice? I mean, I know you're saying that it was during the lockdown season, but you suddenly thinking, right, okay, there's been 50 centimeters of fresh snow. We've got to get over to this place.
Well, whenever you're making a ski film, you have to be ready to drop everything, full commitment, and go to where it's good. For that project, it was a little bit harder because you had to, a lot of the production crew were in Austria, so it had to drive over the border and get to Italy. You got people looking at the weather reports, at snow forecasting, and then all while they're like, oh, we're going to be closing international borders. And we had all the paperwork to say we're working and we're allowed to do it. But I think there were a couple of times when there may have been a ski tour over the border at a time as well to be able to go and film. So yeah, it's just about being able to react. But when there's a project like that, all the riders are committed, all the production are committed. So you do whatever it takes to make something like that happen.
I like the way you're talking about being able to react and respond quickly, because another film I wanted to ask you about is a very different kind of scale from The Ultimate Run, but you could call it The Ultimate Run in Sheffield, possibly, because we had some snow in the UK, I think it was last year, was it? And, you know, I wondered how, because you're normally based in Europe, you filmed it in Sheffield, you're skiing through the streets of Sheffield. How did that come together?
I mean, that's always been a dream of mine, to ski in the UK on snow. It's just a really magical feeling to be able to ski at home. When I was a kid, maybe driving up to the ski slope, you're looking around town and you're like, oh, imagine if it skied here, if it snowed here, you could ski down there and you could hit that rail, you can make a jump there. I mean, as time progressed, I was like, oh, this is not going to happen. But last year, you know, there was reports of snow. I actually skied with Billy Morgan down in the south of the UK when there was the big beast from the east a few years ago. It was really fun, but neither of us had any connection to where we were skiing. We were just skiing in the snow because it had been snowing. And the problem with snow in the UK is that it doesn't last for long. So we knew that there was snow coming last year. It didn't look that promising, because to uproot here, get on a flight, go over there, and it snowed 10 centimeters and it lasts half the day, it's not worth it. And last year we were sort of looking at conditions, looking at the forecast, and it was like, it's not going to happen. And then Friday morning of the week when this big snowstorm was supposed to happen, I think the big snowstorm was supposed to happen on a Wednesday, it put down 10 centimeters, you know, it's, you can't go skiing on that. But Friday morning, my brother sent me a text message about 6 o'clock in the morning, I guess, UK time. There were pillows on his wheelie bin, you know, a good 30, 40 centimeters. And I was like, all right, that actually looks good. I had a quick look on the forecast and it was cold. It was going to stay cold until Saturday morning. And I was like, okay, if we're going to do it, we need to go. So I called up Red Bull UK. They were like, yeah, come over. We'll get you up there. I called up Matt McCormick. He's a filmer with Legs of Steel. But yeah, we were on a 10 o'clock flight out of Innsbruck. It was a 4x4 waiting for us once we were at the airport in case we run into troubles getting to Sheffield and we hit the road.
You left Innsbruck, you got a text message from your brother Friday morning. Within a couple of hours, you're on a flight. You're arriving in the UK. You still got to get up there. So you didn't get up there till the afternoon or something. But the snow's still there. You're a bit nervous. You're getting live updates as you're on the motorway.
It was, I think by the time we were in the car, it was about 1. And we started driving up. We were driving up the A1. There was no snow. And we were in Worksop, which is 10 minutes from my parents' house. And there was still no snow. And we'd also got another filmer coming down from Fort William, Brody, and we were like, oh my god, we need to call Brody and tell him to stop driving because he'd got a mammoth drive coming down. But then all of a sudden, literally 5 minutes from my parents' house, there was snow. You could sort of see it on the sort of those rolling hills you have in Sheffield, but it was just so localized, the snow. So there was quite a lot of my parents, and then we were like, right, we said hi to mom and dad, picked up a couple of shovels, went into Sheffield city centre, and then halfway into Sheffield, there's not much snow here. But then by the time we got into town, the first spot we went to, which I always had on my mind because it has a nice view, there was still quite a lot of snow there. So that was probably 7 or 8 o'clock, and we were like, right, we can make this work. So we went to this park above the train station. It's a big hill, and it looks out onto Sheffield. It'd been sledged basically by every man and his dog in Sheffield, been sledging. But luckily there were a lot of snowmen around that people had built. So we started collecting snowmen until about midnight, and we managed to build a jump. It was still freezing as well. But we built a jump, finished it about midnight, and we were just like, oh, we hope that jump's there in the morning. Worst case, we get a picture. But we went back six o'clock maybe, jump was still there, light got nice, it was still cold, so we hit the jump, and then we started to hit a few more features around that park, and then we started to drive off and started looking for more places to ski, and we managed to film until Sunday morning. And it started to heat up a bit by then and started to melt, but we got a few of the last shots. Actually had our breakfast just below the ski village in Sheffield where there was no snow, and managed to put the edit together.
That's fantastic. I can tell, you know, obviously you're passionate about making films anyway, but to do something really personal like that where you're able to do it in your hometown, even better. There's a couple of shots where you're going down the street and, you know, people at the sides are just, they're sort of clearing the snow off their cars, and they're just like, did I just see someone ski past? Those are one shot type of things. You didn't get to practice those, or did you get to practice them?
No, it was literally like we would go somewhere and we'd be like, that looks like a snowy street and it's steep enough to go down. Because that's another thing as well, is when it comes to skiing in the streets or in the UK, it's the gradient of what you're skiing down, which makes a difference. And luckily Sheffield is pretty hilly. And the snow clearing wasn't that good on some of the smaller streets. We didn't want to annoy anyone as well. So
yeah, well, it's brilliant. And, you know, it's interesting. I said, you know, that's a personal project. But it's also slightly different from some of the other films you've done, because, you know, it really was you know, something short, put together, you know, right at short notice. And you've done lots of stuff for Red Bull. There's some great how-to guides on their website, including one which I thought would be exceptionally niche, where you talk about how to do a slash or a spray after you've dropped a cliff. There can't be that many people who want to watch that, but it's had 60,000 views. But more recently for Red Bull, and I'm wondering, we might come on to whether people's attention spans and whether they're just shorter now, maybe TikTok generation, etc. But there's one that some people will undoubtedly have seen without knowing at all that you were in it or involved in it, which is just kind of labeled, I think the title might be Skiers Jump Over Chairlift, which came out, you know, earlier this year. And that's had 3 million views. And that was a Red Bull project, right?
So Red Bull often put on training camps for us, for athletes to get together. They'll build really nice jumps, really nice parks, so you can go and practice and get some time on snow with the team. And at the end of last year, they put together this insane park in Mammoth Mountain. Mammoth had a record-breaking year. They'd got, I don't know, 25 meters of snow at the top of the mountain. It was 8 meters of snow down at the lodge. All these lodges and buildings, usually they're two stories. It looked like a one-story building. And we went out there, and the whole Red Bull snow team got together, skiers and snowboarders, and the skiers got together, and they made this snake run, sort of like a continuous shot party run with your friends, which was absolutely amazing to do. Logan Peyota, he's a freeride skier from Canada, but he's also really good on snowmobiles. He was jumping the park jumps on a snowmobile. And one of the shots in it, Kirsty Muir and I, we're jumping next to Logan. He goes off the jump in front of us on the snowmobile, and we're right next to him on the sides.
Yeah, I mean, it's brilliantly, brilliantly choreographed, everything that's put together. And I know it was in Mammoth. I mean, you said they were cooperative, but you know, the title is Skiers Jump Over a Chairlift. You're literally going over the top of the chairlift at the end. I mean, you know, probably all, you know, all in the edit, but you know, that must have been a bit of, you have to persuade them quite a lot to get them to allow you to do that.
It was funny, we showed up to the park and they were like, yeah, and down there we've built a jump over chair four or whatever it is, and everyone was like, okay, right. A lot of the time when you go out filming, you're building the jumps yourself, either by hand, or you might be lucky enough to be able to build something with a machine as well. But when you show up somewhere and someone else has built something and as crazy as jumping over a chairlift, you know, you really have to have a look, and you have to be really confident in the people that have built it. But they have an amazing park team there, and they built everything to perfection.
You mentioned Kirsty Muir just then. I've interviewed her on the podcast before. And, you know, she's obviously part of the Red Bull team. She is the new generation, let's say the third, possibly the fourth. I'm not too sure, you know, coming through, an amazing athlete. She's obviously a bit younger than yourself. You know, you maybe might be what we call a veteran, you know, on the free skiing side of things now. You've obviously had, you know, injuries down the track. But how do you keep yourself in shape? How do you keep yourself fit so you can keep up with the new groms?
I had my first knee injury in 2011. Since that injury, I realized that, you know, training off the slopes is also as important as training on the slope, looking after your body. And again, down to Red Bull, they have a great team that looks after the athletes for doing gym work, for training, you know, aerial awareness, trampolines, on the slopes as well. They have a great medical team, and it's one of the only companies I know out there that, you know, that have this. It's almost like having a football club, training facilities that you can make the most of. They have a facility in Austria, just outside of Fuschl, where the headquarters is, and they have a full medical team there. They have a sports psychologist for you to talk to. They have nutritionists. They have all the trainers, physios. So as much as I can, take advantage of that, go to the gym during the off season. And then I also like to spend a lot of time on a bike in the summer. Yeah, just got to look after your body as you get older.
And when you say a lot of time on the bike, I think, you know, maybe the listeners should be made aware that we're talking about a lot of time. You've done some mighty bike rides, right?
I kind of got the cycling bug, as I did with skiing all that time ago. It was actually, I had a knee injury and I went to see a doctor and he looked at my knee and he's like, oh, you should probably get your ACL done again. And I was like, well, that's not an option for me. And I left that appointment thinking, right, what can I do, you know, which will benefit me, benefit my joints and keep me fit? And I was like, right, I'm going to start biking. That's going to be good. I've seen a lot of people biking, but I just wasn't into road biking. I was like the Lycra, the small tires and everything. I was like, I don't think I can do that. And I went to the local bike shop in Sheffield, actually. They had road bikes, but they had bigger tires on them. And it was called a gravel bike. And I was like, okay, that's kind of cool. Maybe I can get away with that. I can bought into that. And I ended up with a gravel bike and started training on that. A few summer seasons later, I'd started doing bigger rides, like these more endurance rides. My longest ride then was about 300 kilometers. I would ride from Innsbruck to Zurich, where my wife's from. I try and do that every summer. And then one of my sponsors approached me, Evoc. They said, oh, we're doing this bike ride on the summer equinox, the longest day. I was like, okay, that sounds cool. I was like, what is it? They're going to follow from the source of the river Inn all the way to its mouth, whatever, to the end. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. You know, the river Inn, I live in Innsbruck. That's really nice. And then, yeah, well, it's 520 kilometers and we're going to do it in a day, or the longest day. I was like, okay. I was like, well, I'm on board. I'll do it. So that was, we started at 9 o'clock in the morning in Maloja in Switzerland. And we finished in Passau, Germany, at about 9:30 or 10 o'clock the next day. There were some very, very sore legs after that.
Well, legs of steel, as we referred to earlier. Now, you know, as well as, you know, skiing, you're using them to power bikes around the Alps. And, you know, those really long rides like that, great for endurance and for strength as well. And I should probably mention, you mentioned your sponsors and different support from people. And, you know, we've obviously covered Red Bull and Volcal. It's actually Stance Socks that brought us together today. So I feel obliged to give them a mention. It's a new partnership this year, right?
It is, yeah. I was being a huge fan of Stance for a long time. Obviously, as a professional athlete, you get a lot of free kit over the years. But Stance, I was drawn to them, I don't know when I first saw the socks they did, but they started making colorful socks, like interesting socks, cool artwork on them and things, and had a few pairs over the years. And it was actually during, I think it was also like pandemic, you know, when everyone's turned to online shopping. I remember having a bit of a shopping spree one day and ending up with a few pairs, and they're amazing. And last year started a partnership with them. Yeah, for me, I think the best thing, apart from the brand having really cool looking products, are the ski socks. They're really technical, really good. And as you know, with skiing and performance, it starts from the first layer that you put on. So socks are important. And a lot of people, when they think of ski socks, they think that you need the thickest ski socks, or you need to wear two pairs of ski socks because, you know, your boots aren't comfy. But it's actually having thin socks, which I find to be the best performing. You get the best feel from them to the rest of your equipment. And yeah, that's why I can really stand behind the product that I have now with Stance.
Cool. I did have a look at their website, and you're right about those designs. There's kind of all sorts of partnerships and things going on. I think there's some Star Wars socks in there and things like that as well. I'll stick a link into the show notes there. So last week I was out in Verbier and I came across a brand that I'd never come across before called Houdini. And are they your clothing sponsor?
They are, yeah. I started working with them last year as well. They're a Swedish company. They have a really nice brand message, like ethos, sustainability, amazing products. One thing I did last summer, actually, with them, they had a little activation last summer called Live Large with Less, and it was basically about, you know, you don't need to buy lots of clothes and have lots of stuff in your wardrobe. So I took on the challenge last summer to cut down my wardrobe to 10 items of clothing. In the beginning, I was very doubtful of. I was like, oh, that's not going to happen. You know, I need all my clothes. But at the start of the summer, I packed up my wardrobe basically and replaced it with these 10 items from Houdini. It was really eye-opening experience to, you know, to sort of streamline your wardrobe and realize what you do and what you don't need. And yeah, that lasted for 3 months, 10 items. And then when the time came to unpack everything, basically, I think a lot of it stayed in storage or went to the charity shops.
That's excellent. Houdini actually crossed my path because I was in Verbier and there's a new company there called Circle Supply, ski clothing rental. And Houdini is one of the brands, along with Patagonia and Picture Organic, who has that very high sustainability threshold that they work with. So that's really interesting to hear that as well. It's been a brilliant conversation. This podcast is going to be slightly longer than some of my normal ones, but that's because I've really, you know, enjoyed everything and I found it really interesting what we've been talking about. Yeah, you know, I mentioned that you are, you know, maybe one of the veteran skiers, you know, out there. I wondered what advice you would offer to an aspiring, I guess, in two questions: one to a filmmaker, and one to an aspiring free skier, you know, who's looking to break through.
Well, I mean, everything comes from, you know, from passion and the driving force to want to get somewhere. And I think if you have a passion for something and you enjoy doing it, then you should pursue it. It's not always easy, and you know, there's going to be some big ups and some downs. But if you believe in something, and you know that's what you want to do, then you have to get after it. When I first started skiing, it wasn't oh, you know, this is your job now. It was working, collecting trolleys at the supermarket in Sheffield in order to be able to go and do a ski season. It was working as a gardener and things like that in order to be able to pursue my passion. And I think now, especially now, with social media and so many different platforms where you can show your work and express your creativity, it's a good time to sort of get your name out, get your work out. As much as I'm not as much as of a fan of social media, but it is a great sort of place to work in. And I also say to people, a lot of people write me messages or emails and things asking, you know, how to become a pro skier and, you know, how to crack the scene and things like that. And I always say that maybe you don't actually need to be the best at something, but you need to obviously have a talent and a story to tell. And maybe you're not going to be the best skier, but there are so many more opportunities within ski industry to be able to create and to find opportunity, whether you're clothing designer or you're into marketing, or that there's so much to do. You don't need to go out there and win those comps all the time. There's so much to do out there. And maybe that starts from working in a chalet or as a ski instructor or anything, just to get out there on snow, and then you'll find a community and find people with a like mind.
That is brilliantly summarized, Paddy. And I think, you know, it's true. I think most people who are listening to this podcast have a passion for the sport. And I'm sure a lot of them out there have a story to tell as well. And I really appreciate you sharing your story with us today. You know, it's really been interesting listening to it. So thank you very much for your time today, Paddy.
Yeah, thank you as well. And thank you for everything you've done in the industry, especially back in the day when we natives used to be sponsoring the events and you were getting people out on snow, getting jobs. Yeah, thank you.
So I really enjoyed talking to you, Paddy, and hopefully you enjoyed our conversation too. Now, I enjoy all feedback about the show. I like to know what you think, especially about our features. So please contact me on social at Ski Podcast or by email, theskipodcast@gmail.com. Recently contacted by Tim Boyes, who said, I'm living in Morgin, Switzerland, in the Port du Soleil. I think I was that guy who you recently mentioned who listened to your first episode. I retired from the Swiss Alps in 2017. I've been listening since then. I love the early episodes with Jim, but I have to say your podcast has only gone from strength to strength since you took it on alone. Keep up the good work. You keep giving me so many ideas, I can't keep up. And he goes on to say he's listened to all 214 episodes and has decided there's so much quality content, he's going to go back and listen again. Now, long-time listener Chris Howie contacted me. He said, loving the podcast. Can we do more from Argentina, Chile, New Zealand, please? Well, don't forget we have a couple of New Zealand special episodes in our back catalogue. They are episodes 73 and 97. But I can tell you that in our next episode, we are going to be looking at Chile. So tune in for that one. And finally, thanks to a user called RMS1765, who gave us a 5-star Apple review and who said, I love the mix of guests on this podcast and everything you're doing to raise awareness about the issues facing skiing. So thank you very much for that. Now, if you do like the podcast, there are a couple of things you can do to help. You can review us as RMS1765 did on Apple Podcasts or also on Spotify, and that actually helps other listeners find us. So I really appreciate that. You can subscribe, and that means every episode will automatically be downloaded for you so you can catch up at your leisure. And now there are now 216 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with. And I guess it's because we're in the off season now, but a mere 91 of those were listened to in the last week. And across those 7 days, 50% of our listeners were in the UK, 18% in the States, and the remaining 32% across the world, including Portugal, Taiwan, and Brazil. So wherever you are listening to the podcast, thank you for joining us, and I hope you keep enjoying it. You can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at The Ski Podcast. But for now, I'd like to thank Stance Socks for helping to arrange this interview, and thank my guest today, Paddy Graham. Finally, listener, thank you for joining us, and until next time, goodbye.